call the Senate House Committee to order. Present are Senator Josephson, Senator Jones, and Senator Fisher. The way we will do it today, it'll be Senate Bill 1 is what we'll be taking up first. There are some people that did sign in to testify. And some of you, I don't know if you've seen the committee substitute, that's incorporating some of the situations we had the last time. And if I get a motion from a committee member, what we ought to do, go ahead, Senator Josephson.
I move that the committee adopt the committee substitute for Senate Bill Number 1 for purposes of discussion and consideration.
Okay, any objections? Okay, then what we have before us is Senate, or committee substitute for Senate Bill 1. So we have some people have signed in. Let's see, we'll start that way. Senator Duncan will be back later. He may have some comments at the end. So why don't we go with Deborah Keller? Just give your name, and if you want to say town, that's fine.
Okay. I'm Deborah Keller, and I'm from Juneau, and I represent the Governor's Council of Handicapped and Gifted. And we feel that the committee substitute is a very positive step. We also feel that it strengthens SB 1 and tightens it. Mm-hmm. And we've been very supportive of it, and we will continue giving it our full support.
Any questions? Okay, thank you. Dee Hagmeyer.
My name is Lee Hagmeyer. I'm with the Division of Vocational. I'm representing the Division of Vocational Rehabilitation. And we strongly support CSS Bill, CSS B1. The Division of Vocational Rehabilitation works with individuals who have a physical or mental disability that represents a substantial handicap to employment. And our objective is for those individuals to improve the quality of their life. And the bill that you have before you creates an opportunity for individuals to obtain greater control over their lives as handicapped persons. Now, in the last 6 months, I've interviewed probably a little over 50 people who clearly have mental or physical disabilities. And these people will need to have access as they assume their new lives as handicapped individuals, have access to credit and loan and the other provisions that are provided for by this bill.
Okay, any questions? Okay, thank you, Mr. Hagmeyer. Christy Hagmeyer.
Mr. Chairman, I'm waiting for a piece of additional information. Could I testify later?
How long is this piece of information going to be?
Just be here in a few minutes.
Okay.
Minutes or so.
Okay, because if it's that critical and it's not here, we're going to hold it off to Friday.
Oh, that's fine. No, go ahead and with your other persons.
Okay, there is only one more. Gail Horesky.
After that part of it.
I think we have some questions for you, then, Gail, too.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Gail Horesky. I'm with the Criminal Division of the Department of Law. I was asked to come over this afternoon because evidently there were some questions. So I have no prepared remarks. I'll be glad to answer any questions.
Okay, Senator Jones.
Chairman. For the law, you would have to have an interpreter, I presume. If someone, if that person was amongst the jury.
Presumably, yes, sir.
Now, how do you handle that in a courtroom where a third person is interpreting to what's going on?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I received a call to come over here just about an hour ago and was not able to do any in-depth research on any of those issues. I was able to, however, find some annotations regarding the propriety of using both deaf and blind people on juries. And the research that I was able to do this afternoon, there are many, many cases that deal with the issue of deafness among jurors. Every single case that I found, and we're talking about a neighborhood of 20 or so, dealt with the issue of whether the person's handicap, impairment, was of sufficient nature that he or she was unable to hear the evidence. And so then all of the cases turned on how deaf was this person, how great was the impairment. Mr. Chairman, I found absolutely no cases in any jurisdiction in which a person who was totally deaf was allowed to sit on a jury, and I'm not aware of any jurisdiction that allows that practice. I think that the reason that it probably is not allowed, so far as I'm aware, anywhere, is exactly the issue that you've raised, Senator, which is there are severe and very strict constitutional limits on the outside influences that can be brought to bear to a jury, including unauthorized objects in the room, any documents that haven't been admitted into evidence, any unauthorized people in the room during deliberations, and that could be someone like the bailiff, who has every right to be involved with the jury and have contact with the jury, but has no right at all to be in there with the deliberations. I don't think there's any case law on whether or not a verdict that was reached by a jury of 12 people and a 13th person was there interpreting at the time, I don't believe there is any case law as to whether or not that would be a valid verdict, because I don't believe it's ever been done.
Senator Joseph.
Well, I think the point is that, I'm sure that research is correct, I think the point is that the legislature is presented with a policy option of bringing a new dawn, a new day to the rights of deaf or blind people who want the opportunity to serve as jurors and as citizens on juries. My understanding is that it is customary when these witnesses and so forth, when there's a language barrier or a problem of hearing loss, to provide either translators or signers, and that there is a procedure in the courtroom for the in-court deputy to swear those people that they will conscientiously provide the information or relay to the court the information. You're familiar with that?
Yes, sir, I am.
Yes.
Okay. The question that I have is I just happened to pick up our local paper back home. There's a murder trial going on. And one of the things, the headline is, jury reviews videotape of so-and-so's statement. And I guess my problem is, in the case of a blind person, how can you translate a videotape to that particular person who's going to have to make a decision on somebody's innocence or guilt? And that's where I'm coming from. Nothing against, you know, handicapped folks. It's just that I don't know. And I thought maybe you could shed some light as to, you know, during, as the case goes on, this could be a mechanism by the defense to get the jury disqualified or something, if at the heat of it saying it's critical. Without this person seeing this, my case just isn't going to work. I don't know. Does that seem like a legitimate concern or not?
Mr. Chairman, I think it's a very legitimate concern, and it's a concern that we share as well. I think that anyone who's familiar with the trial practice understands that there are two main categories where a person's ability to see could be extremely important in an individual case. And one is that one of the things we expect jurors to do is to judge the credibility of witnesses. That is, who's lying, who doesn't recall correctly, who's forgotten, and who can be relied upon. And in addition to comparing the facts which come out of the trial and listening to the verbal testimony of the witnesses, one of the things that jurors do is judge the demeanor of the person. Body language, for want of a better word. Does he fidget? Was he willing to look people in the eye? When they were looking at him, did they get a sense that he just wasn't telling the truth? And the cases that I have found regarding persons who were considered to be disqualified for service as jurors because of a sight impairment, blindness, specifically pointed to that issue, that is, the inability to judge the demeanor of the witnesses as denying the defendant a fair and impartial trial, because they said this juror couldn't deliberate with the other jurors on the same basis because he had not seen part of the evidence. The other main area where that would be a concern to us, Senator, is in many, many cases you have physical exhibits, charts, diagrams, checks, documents, where someone would be required, for example, to decide whose handwriting was that, or what path somebody took when they ran from the scene of a crime, things of that sort, videotapes of the scene, jury viewing of the scene when they go out to where the accident occurred or whatever the situation happens to be. And it's because of that concern, in addition to the demeanor, that many courts have held blind jurors are disqualified. Ken, many of the cases that I found dealt with the degree of impairment and saying, well, this person was able to see well enough. And it also turned on a statutory interpretation in some of the cases. Some cases held because of the statute, blindness was per se a disqualification. Some courts have held, construing the particular statute in their state, that it's not blindness as opposed to deafness, that blindness was not a per se disqualification, but they had to look at, in that case, was identification of the suspect going to be a major issue, in which case a composite photo the jury would have to look at, et cetera, et cetera. So there is much more difference in how the courts have treated blindness than how they have treated deafness, although as a general rule they have found blindness to be a disqualification.
Senator Jones.
Well, I suppose, you know, I've heard the anecdotes that people who are blind have compensation in the way they deal with the world. I don't mean to be facetious, but I suppose from their point of view, the best jury would be consisting of 12 blind people who have more intuition and more compensatory skills than those of us who aren't blind. My feeling about it, and maybe you could comment on this, was initially to have a lot of the same concerns that have been expressed by yourself and Senator Fisher, because as we measure the rights of the individual who wants to be on the jury, we can't forget the rights of the plaintiff and the rights of the defendant or, in the criminal case, the accused. But I assume that, as you say, that there are, of course, challenges for cause available to both sides, and I assume that in a particular case, the judge may expand the challenges for cause or make specific arrangements dealing with specific problems. And that gave me some degree of comfort. Does the Department of Law then have a position about these proposals?
No, sir. I, as I mentioned, was just called about an hour or so ago and asked to come for questions. I had no opportunity at all to confer with anyone. We're certainly not in a position of having an official.
Well, the same proposition was before the 14th legislature. Was there then a position paper by the department indicating objection to the idea of blind or deaf people on the jury?
Mr. Chairman, to my knowledge, Senator, there was no position paper one way or the other submitted by the Department of Law on that legislation.
Any other questions? Okay, thanks, Gil. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, the committee members, for the additional moment. Gather some additional information. My name is Christine Hagmeyer, and I'm here actually in two capacities, one representing the Department of Health and Social Services to again verse our support for this bill and the committee substitute that's been presented. And if I may move over to my second hat and perhaps address some of the questions that were posed by the last individual, I probably can answer a few things that were presented. I'm also a member of the National Association of the Deaf, and I am totally deaf. And I can tell you that to date there are 11 states that do allow deaf jurors, and Washington State was the first. There are numerous cases that also have allowed blind jurors. And I think that the committee's in kind of a unusual situation having a totally deaf and a totally blind couple that happen to be here who have also been involved in these national issues. I could speak freely for at least those individuals that I have worked with on the particular issue that you raise, and that deaf individuals as a whole do not want to be in a situation which does not realistically provide information to us equally as it would to a hearing person. legal interpreters, as legal sign language interpreters, as they are so certified, on an average have six years of training and are certified for specific legal interpreting. Those skills are well documented, and the confidentiality issues, the all of the issues that have been presented have been gone over by 11 other states beyond our own. With regard to issues pertaining to blind individuals, I think Dr. Hagmeier could possibly offer some information on that. But I think the biggest point is that as individuals, we too seek a jury of our peers. And I think that that's a right that we would like to see in place in the state of Alaska as well.
Well, of course, the issue of a jury of your peer comes up if a blind or deaf person is a party to the lawsuit. I mean, it really is more than that, because the claim or desire is to help adjudicate cases where the parties are not blind or deaf.
That's right. And just as citizens, I think you can understand our desire to partake in the process. I know that my name's been taken off the rolls for years now. I haven't been notified since probably 1979, when I answered the questionnaire, are you, you know, hearing impaired? And I've never gotten a computer printout since then.
Mr. Chairman, I have made many arguments before hearing impaired juries myself. And we have the same problem on the floor of the Senate. Right?
I'm glad you said that, and I didn't. Are there any questions?
Thank you.
Thank you again for the opportunity to testify.
There seems to be another question, and maybe the sponsor might be able to answer this. One of the other questions seems to be in the case of credit application. If a handicapped person gets turned down, it appears from the bill that it's up to the credit institution to prove they were not turned down because they were handicapped. And that seems to be a concern by some of the credit folks, as to where does that let them, cost-wise, and especially in front of the Human Rights Commission, if the party says that's why I was turned down, how are they going to disprove something like that?
Chair, I'm trying to find the language you're referring to.
Mr. Chairman, can I offer some suggestion on that, since I did research that last year? Excuse me.
I don't know.
Pardon me for stepping out of role.
Actually, Section 5 would be something else.
I have done some research on this issue from last year's versions. And what I was involved in was a contact to the Federal Reserve Bank, their Consumer Affairs Office in San Francisco. And I contacted a Mr. Robbins in San Francisco, who is the person who handles all the regulations involved with the determination of use of the Equal Credit Opportunity Law, which is a law that all but banks follow in determining what their applications are permitted to ask. And Mr. Robbins did definitely assure me that any questions that pertain solely to the fact that a person was physically handicapped or mentally handicapped would not be permitted under the existing federal law. And that is his interpretation. I could offer the committee a telephone number to contact him, but federal law does not permit that question anyway. It'd be similar to asking on an application if a woman was pregnant, because the concern might be that person might not continue working, or a person lived in a certain neighborhood that might not be considered desirable.
You're saying that the federal law now does this, takes care of it.
That's right.
Okay,
it does not allow that.
Then the question that I would have to follow up, then, why are we going to allow an Alaskan commission to adopt regulations, et cetera, which may or may not be the same as the federal regulations?
Excuse me, or maybe I said it in reverse. Is that the federal law prohibits asking that question that we in the state law also would prohibit under this bill.
The other way to word your statement is, excuse me, Mr. Chairman, is the federal law already
prohibits
speaks of this, and we're just making the state law, bringing the state law into conformance.
That's right? Exactly right.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Josephson.
The federal law prohibits asking what?
Asking in an application whether a person is physically or mentally handicapped. They may ask all the questions to determine creditworthiness, But Bosdab specifically asked that question, Mr. Robbins said, would not be permitted under section 2024 of the Equal Credit Opportunity Law.
Say that again. They can ask for some things, but they can't ask.
Okay. The it's called the Equal Credit Opportunity Law, and it is Regulation B of Section 202.4, and it says that on the prohibitive basis, they cannot ask questions which would be of a prohibitive basis. And then I asked for the commentary on that and the definition. The definition does go into all of the protected classes that we address. And on the question of handicap, he said that there has been a ruling that handicap would be included in that. The person is that under the federal law, banks are not allowed to, in loan applications or credit applications, ask the question, are you physically or mentally handicapped?
Okay, but the language that is of concern here has to do with more than asking the question. It has to do with refusal to extend credit.
Right.
And I think the argument is, the anxiety in the banking community is, that of course they should not be permitted to refuse to extend credit to a creditworthy person who has a mental disability.
Right.
But there may be certain types of mental disability which are relevant to the issue of creditworthiness. So it becomes a logical problem if you decide that the person is not creditworthy and you consider the mental disability whether you ask about it or not, which is known to you, and which is a factor,
mm-hmm.
are you creating a performing a criminal act?
Well, my impression is if the person isn't creditworthy in the first place, you don't need to make mention of what may be obvious as a physical or mental handicap. I mean, we could go through all the lists of the mental disabilities, and there are examples of people who are schizophrenic and manic depressive. I mean, I hate to deny Mr. McFarland the opportunity to get a loan because he might now be considered mentally handicapped.
I just had lunch today with a psychologist who told me that schizophrenia and manic depressiveness are sometimes adaptive, and some very successful people are schizophrenics and manic depressives.
I would agree.
And they're famous people and celebrities and
presidents,
rock and roll stars. I don't think president. Oh,
sorry.
No presidents.
All right.
So, but there may be certain situations where a person with a mental disability seeks a loan, and the loan officer knows or believes in good faith that the mental condition would impair that ability, that person's ability to repay.
You know, I feel uncomfortable with that, and I feel uncomfortable with that because what I think we have here is a situation where a person has been shown by the same standards to be creditworthy. They have a work history or they have a financial credit history that is equivalent to what the bank's requirements are. And then I'd hate to put bank tellers and loan officers in the business of doing psychological assessments. I think that's what's awkward here, is that bill really is working to say if these individuals are creditworthy, they shouldn't be discriminated against in other circumstances.
Well, let me just try to put some legislative history into this record.
Okay.
Would you agree that a banker would not be susceptible to, or should not be susceptible to, a civil or criminal penalty if he or she declines to make a loan to someone who is not creditworthy just because that person is also suffering from a mental disability?
Okay. There's no just because there, because you're saying the person is not creditworthy.
No, I'm saying, would you agree that there should not be a liability based solely on the fact that the claimant has a mental disability if the loan is declined to somebody who is not creditworthy?
Okay. I think that's a double-edged sword, because what we're asking in this bill is that people be looked at with regard to their creditworthiness.
That's what I'm saying.
Okay, and if a person happens to be not creditworthy, you don't need to look any further. Am I missing your point?
Yes, I think so, or I'm missing yours, which is
okay.
Equally likely.
Won't be the first.
Let me put it another way.
Yeah.
Joe Smith has a mental disability. Joe Smith is not creditworthy. Joe Smith goes down to the National Bank of Alaska to borrow money. The banker looks at his financial statement or credit history and says, or collateral, and says, I'm not going to lend the money to you, Joe. What the lenders want to avoid is that Joe runs to court and successfully maintains a case by saying, I was mentally disabled and I was declined a loan.
Okay.
You agree that in that hypothetical, no action should lie, don't you?
I don't think that it would need to occur because it's the same as a race situation that comes up where a person happens to be black and they're not creditworthy, or they're green and they're not creditworthy. If a person takes that individual to court, the issue is that they're not creditworthy. Isn't that correct? Am I misunderstanding you still?
No, I understand you. I understand you.
Okay.
Your answer. I think your answer follows what I'm trying to elicit.
I think we're actually saying the same thing. There will be circumstances where a person, for any number of reasons, might go into a credit institution and say, no, it wasn't my creditworthiness you denied me on. You denied me because I am Jewish. And banks deal with that every day. But
you see, I think the difference is, and the reason, if I might pursue this, Mr. Chairman, without hopefully laboring it, is that at this stage of our development as a society in 1987, we all agree that being Jewish or black or Chinese or an Eskimo or a woman is irrelevant, logically, to any issue of creditworthiness or character or ability or desire to pay. And I think we would agree, as I said a minute ago, that in most cases it is also irrelevant to the issue of mental disability. That a mentally disabled person may be functionally able to pay and have the same intent to pay and have the same creditworthiness. But in this particular area, there may be some factual situations where there is a relevant nexus between the mental disability and creditworthiness, which does not exist in any of the other cases. And I think that is the reason why potential lenders have a concern here. And I think we can address the concern, and I think by this kind of dialogue we address it. Because if there is a court case, it would be clear that the legislators thought about this and had a clear intent of the value of this discussion.
Okay, my feeling is that there are always going to be people who might have something come up that changes their creditworthiness, but as an applicant, their history should speak for itself. That's the only thing I can think of. Any other questions?
No.
Thank you very much.
Originally I said about getting the bill out today, and I really want to, and I would hope that the committee would agree. We can either hold it till Friday, because I think there is some current concern on Section 1 from the Department of Law. We can hold it and make sure we get them in to make formal statements where they're for or against. We can delete it and pass it on to Judiciary, because Senator Josephson's also on Judiciary, and that can be reinstated then. So. But I would feel very uncomfortable passing it out as is and leaving Section 1 in place without further review. So if somebody would care to amend it and move that out, we can move the bill out today. Otherwise, we're going to have to hold it to Friday, because I do think Department of Law has to really be involved. And I was gone for 2 days, and I apologize. Maybe that's why Gail didn't get over in time. Yes, Senator Chairman,
you know, whatever you'd like to do in the committee, let me just restate the fact that this bill has been in for the past 3 years. It went clear through all the committee process last year in the Department of Law. I don't know where they've been, but they've had plenty of time to formulate a position on that question. And quite honestly, it hasn't. I mean, they reviewed it last year. I'm quite sure this bill went under a lot of review, and I'm not sure. I guess my alternate suggestion would be to move the bill on and let Judiciary ask for position paper on that.
Well, we're talking 2 days. You know, and that's the only question, I think. The other question was credit. That seems to have been satisfied. The only thing left is that, and I think there is some obligation that the committee also make sure that something goes out that is the best reliable thing that we can come up with. So that, we're just going to, I guess the best thing would be just to hold it over to Friday. This would be the first business, and if law doesn't show, then we go on with it. But it's 2 days is what we're talking about. So maybe it's not that bad for 2 days. And I don't think, as far as people coming back and testifying, oh, we're probably not, that's the only question we're going to really be handling. The rest of the bill, there were no concerns at all, so the rest of the bill seems to be well in place. So,
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
That's fine, if that's what you would like to do. I would ask if you be sure the Department of Law finally formulates a position. They've got lots of attorneys in there, they can surely do that. Secondly, I just want to be sure if that's the only problem with the bill at this point. Is the credit question resolved satisfactorily, or are we going to see a last minute effort by some individuals to tie this up into the credit question?
That's a question that I can't answer, Senator.
I've heard this mentioned numerous times, but I've never heard any suggestions from the banking community. Mm-hmm. I'm just getting a little bit discouraged with what I consider to be suggestions to. That are designed to slow the legislation down to such problems.
No,
Senator
Mr.
Joseph.
Chairman, I don't think there's any design to slow it down. I went through this whole issue in 1986, as the Senator says, we've dealt with this year after year after year. In 1986, we intended to solve the problem of the lenders by inserting the phrase, who is otherwise creditworthy, after the new language of physical or mental disability. And I think that was a satisfactory resolution. We have that language in subparagraph 3 on page 9 of the committee substitute. It may be that we need to reiterate that in other portions of the bill. I don't want to indicate to Senator Duncan that issue may not come up in the Judiciary Committee. First of all, I can't speak to the Judiciary Committee. But I think we can say that it's not going to come up Friday in this committee.
Mr. Chairman, I guess my statement, I can't stop the Judiciary Committee either, maybe it should. I guess my statement was more directed at the banking community lobbyists and asking them to get their act together and form other positions instead of just constantly saying we think there's a problem and they never have an alternative.
Now, Senator Duncan, I think the purpose of, and I'm trying to second guess another senator, but I think the purpose of having this discussion with the witnesses, at least on record, we've already covered this particular area. We're saying that we don't want it to be construed that just because somebody is handicapped, they can go running to the Human Rights Commission and say, this is the reason why, and then throw the bank into some kind of a legal thing where they got to keep defending. And I think from the dialogue that went on, I, for one, was satisfied with, I think, because it will be as a matter of record on the bill. So I don't anticipate that coming up again, although you never really know, because two members aren't here. You know, and if they do come back Friday, I don't know what they would do.
Mr. Chairman, going back to Section 1 thing, I don't want to move to delete Section 1 to advance the bill today.
Okay.
Neither alternative you allow is the one I would select. But I think we can give the department, I agree with Senator Duncan, they've had years to come in and haven't done so. Mm-hmm. So I can't imagine it's a big deal to them. In the first place, as a practical matter, the number of jury panels which will have a blind or deaf person on the panel is not going to be a very large number. And although this legislation, as I understand it, would give blind and deaf people the right to serve on juries, it doesn't follow that in every given instance where there is the opportunity, the blind or deaf Alaskan is going to want to serve on the jury. They may have the same problems at that moment in time as some of the rest of us have in serving on juries when we're called. I admire them, by the way, Mr. Chairman, for making this a kind of crusade at a time when a lot of people want to escape jury duty. Here's a group of Alaskans that want to do the public service for $5 or $10 a day, and I think that's to be very highly respected.
By the way, the fiscal note was something like $4,600 or something like that. I mean, it was almost a zero fiscal note. So what we'll do is hold it over to Friday. That'll be the section we're going to take up Friday, and we get that resolved, the vote goes on. So with that, just two more days. So bear with us. Okay. Okay, the next is Senate Bill 66. We'll get to see what's in with this one. Yeah, this.
Does she have to have that?
Yes.
Okay, let's give it to her. Make sure we get a hold of Gail. And somebody from the Department of Law will then come out here and say, yay or nay, this stuff is a concern, and don't say anything. No.
No.
Where? Here.
Oh, okay.
second and I'll go down.
Well, no, I think I'm too long. I'll take care of it.
Yes, you. No, I don't care. Just how we need to have it, right?
Well, there are four against section one. That's what we need now. I need public money. But you could pass something out and then the next person, what a stupid thing, you know? And then I'm saying, do pass something that we actually know something about. I guess it's protecting us more than. I feel probably not too uncomfortable. I don't think so. I
didn't hear
you. I think your line of question is good to settle.
Stay tuned.
Senator Tullis, one of the leaders, but I told him he was going to go with me. I don't have any problem with it, you know. Then again, you know, just. Okay, we're going to go on with Senate Bill 66. And we have, okay, Michael, well, is Senator Kelly here? Or is somebody going to give us a introductory?
May I?
Yes, you may, sir.
I'll be very brief.
No.
For the record, my name is Mark Johnson. I'm counsel to Senator Kelly. I helped draft this bill during the legislative interim with the cooperation of a number of people. As the committee may be aware, the idea of bonding for student loans was an idea originally forwarded by Senator Ferguson during the last legislative session. At that time, it was in 1986, that idea was not carried out, although it was considered by some of the finance committee members at the time. During the interim, it, particularly with in light of the cash flow situation and the acknowledgement that large general fund appropriations were likely not going to be available to help fund the large demand for student loans in the years ahead, Senator Kelly, in cooperation with Senator Ferguson's office and others, put together the bill that you have before you. Senator Kelly has a belief that this is probably the only or the most realistic way that we have of continuing the student loan program in its current form, with recognition of the fact that repayments from outstanding loans are not sufficient to take care of existing loans. So I'm not going to be here to testify as an expert on the mechanisms, the bonding mechanism, the financing mechanism that you have before you in Senate Bill 66, but we would hope that you would embrace the concept that if we are going to have a viable student loan program in the future, that this is probably the best way to go. And I think you'll probably hear a lot more from Kerry Romesberg of the Post-Secondary Education Commission on that topic, and I would urge you to pose technical questions to him. And I think Sterling Gallagher is here, who would be able to testify with regard to the bonding mechanism and questions that you might have about that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, any questions, Senator? Thank you. Michael Smith.
Mr. Chairman, member of the committee. I'm the student president at UAJ, and we...
Mike, can I just say who you are? I mean, your name.
Oh, Michael Smith, yeah. I'm sorry. Some things about this bill. I hope I don't sound too ignorant. I'm not professional at these kind of things, and I have some questions. There's something that's really good about this bonding proposal, and that's that it alleviates our current cash flow problems. I do, however, see a problem in this bill. On page 2, line 10, specifies 24 hours notice for public notice before any meeting in which bonds can be issued. I think 24 hours is a little bit too little time for public notice of a meeting of this nature. I think if you're trying to limit public input, 20 minutes might be a better time to put in there. And if you really want public input, 7 days might be a more reasonable time. I also have a question on page 5, lines 2 and 3. When I read this, I wonder if this means that the interest rate can be modified by the corporation in conjunction with the Post-Secondary Education Commission, despite what the legislature has determined. So that's a question I have there. Like I say, I'm not really sure about how these things work, and I don't want to sound too ignorant. And there are some serious arguments against this bill. The major one is that it will be more costly in the long run for the state. There's no way around that. Carrie Rumsberg spoke to us in our student leader conference meeting here in January, and speaking to students statewide, and he admitted that 20, 30 years down the line, this bonding proposal is going to turn into a black hole that's going to start requiring huge amounts of money from the state general fund just to pay off the bonded indebtedness and not even to fund current loans. So I think that what we need to do is look at this as a short-term solution to an immediate problem, but that for the long run, I don't think that this idea, as it's written or as I understand it, I don't think this is really a long-term solution. An additional point is that it will lock the state into an indebtedness that we can't get out of until the loans are paid off, which are going to get more and more expensive as time goes on. Currently, the money coming back in from the student loan program is nowhere near demand, but I think if you looked at a flow chart, you'd see that we've continued to loan out $80 million a year, and even subtracting the 17% forgiveness or default, that's still going to be a sizable amount of money that's going to start coming back in from the money that's already been loaned out, and that's what they're counting on to be paying these bonds with, or to some extent. So I guess in summary, the students in the state are not in unanimous favor of this proposal. In fact, many of them think it's a real bad idea. It's a quick fix solution, and I think that it could cause real problems in the future for the state of Alaska. And I think that we should look at this as a short-term solution, and maybe look for a better long-term solution to our cash flow problems with the student loans. And I'm open to questions.
Senator Jones? I just have one, Mike. If it, this thing is always called a revolving loan fund, as well as the agriculture revolving loan fund, et cetera. So it's not really a revolving loan fund. We know that we're going to have to subsidize it. But if it were this program where we just dropped the loan program, what would you say? Whether it be short term or long term? In other words, this mechanism of funding versus no student loan program at all, if it really got down to that.
Well, if it got down to, if it came down to a either or, I would have to say this, and I think that we should still continue to look for a better solution in the long run, mm-hmm. because this program is going to cost us.
Okay, thank you. Mary Halloran?
I'm Mary Halloran, Director of Policy for the Office of the Governor, and as we share some of the concerns that have just been raised by Michael Smith on behalf of the students, that's not to say that we're going to oppose bonding as a final solution, but just that it does raise some very genuine concerns. I think, any quick overview of the student loan program shows that it essentially has three parts that make it a non-self-sufficient program, and what we are going to recommend to the legislature in a governor's bill, in fact would dramatically improve the feasibility of the bonding approach, is to tackle the three things that make the program not a revolving loan fund in the true sense. of the subsidy of the program. The second of those is the grace period, the 1 year, which is allowed now between the date of graduation and the date that interest begins to accrue on the loan. And the third is simply the default rate, which, as I'm sure the committee recognizes, is high. The material that I just passed out to you shows in more detailed form what Michael was pointing out to you, which is the general fund requirements for the current student loan program and what happens to them over a longer period of time versus the funding requirements from the general fund with the bonding proposal. And as the chart shows quite clearly, over the long term, you're going to have to pay a lot more with the bonding proposal unless you make other changes in the program itself than you would pay under the current general fund thing. The problem that we have, of course, is that we've got an immediate fiscal crisis, I think is probably the appropriate word. And so the answer is, how do you get out of that? Or the question is, how do you get out of that? We've asked, as a result of these concerns that were raised earlier in a hearing on the companion bill in the House, we asked Sterling Gallagher of the Nuveen Company to run some analysis of what happens to the bonding proposal if, in fact, you delete forgiveness and move the interest date back to the date of graduation rather than giving everyone a year's grace. And basically, you're eliminating two-thirds of the problem if you take those two features out of the current program. He has run those figures. I would defer to him to discuss them with you, but it does substantially improve the bonding proposal. In addition, in terms of the default issue, which is the third major issue in the student loan program, the administration will be supporting statutory changes that will allow us to put a direct lien on permanent fund dividends for those students who are in default. At present, the commission has the ability to put a lien on a PFD, but they had to go through a very complex and complicated court proceeding. And what we would prefer to do is to give them the same kind of authority that the Child Enforcement Division currently has, where they can just take the action without going through the court proceeding. We are also considering, although we haven't reached a final decision, on whether or not we would like to support the co-signer requirement. At the moment, there is the loans do not require a co-signer for anyone, regardless of that person's age. And we're talking with Representative Pierce about her idea that a co-signer be required for those loans given to students who are under age 21. A third issue in the default area is simply administrative due diligence. We're going to be working with Carrie in terms of how can we beef up their procedures so that they, in fact, issue the second, the third, and the fourth notice to people. And it's my understanding that one of their largest problems is simply they lose track of where people are. And so we are going to be looking at how we can help them keep better track by using some of the mechanisms of the Department of Revenue. In addition, it may be necessary, but to also, in the future, because of the size of the state funding, to limit the program to those students who have greater needs rather than making it a first-come, first-served program as it now is. But that's a separate subject that doesn't really impact the bonding proposal one way or another, except it impacts the availability of loans to people in the long run. So I guess in short, for this meeting, I just wanted to raise those concerns with you, tell you that to a certain extent, we're sure that we know how to address two of the three major issues. Our largest problem is how to effectively address the default issue, and we're trying to grapple with that to some extent through the PFD lien. Be glad to answer any other questions that you have right now. I should tell you that we've also asked the Department of Revenue and the Bond Committee to review this proposal, which has not been done formally to this point, because these bonds do require a moral obligation of the state. There is also the fact that under the new federal tax law, there is a ceiling for tax-exempt bonds for the state. The current limit's $250 million. After the end of this calendar year, it's $150 million. we want to know who else is, would be out there competing for that, for bonding under that same cap, and what effect that might have. And then just in general, we're concerned about the any impact that there might be, adverse or otherwise, on the state's credit rating and our ability to manage debt. As you realize, that is going to become a more and more significant issue as we have to turn to more and more issuance of debt to be able to fund capital projects and other programs.
Any questions, Senator? I just have one, and that basically, you're not objecting to the creation of the Alaska Student Loan Corporation. That's not any objection.
Not at this time. We haven't reached a final decision on whether or not that's the best way to go. But I think the thing that bothers me is I would hate for anyone to see this as the solution. The problem are those three issues that I named. It's not the financing mechanism. This is a short-term fix. If you look at the chart, you see that this works for 7 years, and then after that, puts the state in a worse general fund fiscal situation than it would otherwise. So it's what we'd like to do is tackle things for the long term rather than take a 7-year fix. And so the other elements of the program changes that need to be made are more important. This may end up, if you make those other changes, this may end up being the best way to go. I'm just not certain at this point. Sterling just gave me the numbers, for what happens if you make those changes. I've got to, have those reviewed and look them over and make sure it's the best deal.
Yeah, I guess the other comment that I have is that it does go to finance next, and
right.
What you're talking about, most of those issues are dealing with finances, just facing the credit of the state, et cetera, which
yes.
They're probably better able to handle than this committee is. That's why I'm at the creating of the Student Loan Corporation per se, you're not saying it's a terrible thing.
No,
you're saying
no.
You're neutral. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Neutral,
okay.
And that if it were accompanied by other changes in the student loan program, it would definitely be a much better possibility than he has now. Right.
Okay.
If it were left as is now, I think we would probably end up objecting to its creation.
Should this go to finance and a hearing be held, would you be prepared at that time to come up with recommended amendments? Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Well, we're proposing to have a governor's bill on the other aspects of the program. So.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank
Sterling
you.
Sterling Gallagher?
I'd like to go to Dr. Roman.
Was that a cop-out or?
No.
No?
He's a program manager. I'm a consultant.
And I understand he may not be in this position too long, so we better get him up here and... but in any event, this committee will have a crack at him. Go ahead, Doctor.
Thank you. I'm Kerry Romesberg, Director of the Commission on Post-Secondary Education. I don't have any problem with most of what you've heard today, other than the fact that we don't object to the bill as strongly as some other people do. And I'd like to urge the committee to consider two different issues. And one is the bill itself, and another are terms of the loan program. And I really think those are different issues altogether. I don't disagree, and in fact, the commission doesn't have a position on the governor's bill. In all honesty, there is no governor's bill yet, and we hope to see it too pretty soon. And then we can respond to those kinds of conditions. But despite the terms of the loan program, what we're faced with right now is the fact that there simply isn't enough money for student loans. And I think the question that the chair directed earlier it gets right to the point. If indeed there were money for this loan program, if we could come to the legislature and get $56.7 million, I wouldn't be here endorsing this concept either. There's no question about it. There's no question that in the long run, this kind of a concept would end up costing the state more than if we could continue to get the money from the general fund. No question about that either. The thing is, we don't have the money. And our position, the commission's position, my position is we have a very, very good student loan program in the state. It may take some fixing and some tooling up to make it more revolving, but it's an excellent program, and we'd like to see it preserved and continued to provide educational opportunities for Alaskans. This is the mechanism that could give it to us for now. And indeed, even though that little chart that was passed out, you see the line changing. If you look at the cumulative effect, we are talking about expenses that are going to cost a net expense. It's going to take 20 years or so before it really turns into something that's going to cost us money. Another aspect that should be remembered is that we can get out of this program at any given time, assuming that the state's financial situation approves appreciably. Now, it would have to approve appreciably. But the reason we can't is, as opposed to most bond issues, where the bonds that are issued have to support themselves, that's not the way this one is working. We have $380 million sitting out there right now that we have loaned out in student loans over the past 16 years, counting this year. That $380 million and the cash flow from that $380 is what's being pledged against the bonds that will be made over the next, this year and the next 4 or 5 years. There's no problem, even if we stop at that point, the cash flows that are out there are going to pay off these bonds. So we're not sticking the state into a situation where if something happens with the bonds we issue, or the loans we issue next year, if something happens with those in some terrible way, that's not going to affect this bond. It may affect our ability to bond 6 years from now, but not the bonds for the next 3, 4, 5 years. So we've already got a history, we've got a cash flow that's going to be coming in, and that's reflected in the fiscal note. I'd like to address just a couple points that were raised earlier, questions really that were raised by the first gentleman from UAJ that testified. I don't really know the reasoning for 24 hours either. Maybe Sterling knows. We really picked this up. A lot of this was boilerplate from other bond issues, and that's the language they use. If it's unworkable, I can't even address it. I haven't dealt with it. The question about interest, however, I can deal with, which is on the top of page 5, and talks about that the bondholders, if to the extent permitted, that we can modify interest. And indeed, that's what it does do. And not to raise interest, as someone might be concerned about, and I think the students may be concerned about. The problem is this. Under tax-exempt bonds, there are very strong arbitrage rules and regulations. In other words, if the state cannot make money by using federal tax exemptions to issue this. If we start making a profit, we have to rebate that back to the feds. What this says, instead of giving the money back to the feds, we would lower the interest rate to the students. That's what this allows us to do. Now, we don't envision that happening, but who knows what will happen with the bond market. So it could come about, and that's really what that is. What that's all about. There is a problem in the bill. You should be aware of it. It was taken out, by the way, in the House. When they passed it out of House S, they had a committee substitute that took out Section 5. And I don't want anybody to not know what the problem is. Section 5, if I can find it real quickly here, is on the bottom of page 14, about four-fifths of the way down, lines 21, 22, and 23. The underlined portion, it modifies the section of the existing legislation, the existing statutes, I should say, that says who may get a scholarship loan. And it says that a student may not get a loan to attend, and this is the new part, to attend an institution if the default rate on loans made to students to attend the institution exceeds the program default rate by more than 150%, as defined by regulation. Currently, the default rate for the program is 17.5% this month. I never thought I'd say 17.5% is good news, but that's down from the 18.1 and the 18.3 for the last December and November. So it's down to 17.5. That's not a good default rate. But if you look at 17.5%, if you take 150% of that, you got about 26.5% or something like that. And it says, so any school that has a default rate, a history, the students going to that school have a default rate of over 26% would be ineligible for the program. If we did that, and we talked about this briefly once before, if we did that, we would eliminate places such as Anchorage Community College, Islands Community College, Kenai Peninsula Community College, Ketchikan Community College, Kodiak Community College, Kuskokwim Community College. It goes on and on and on. We got some real problems with that section of the bill. You'll notice the last part says, as defined by regulation, and I will just be very honest with this committee, if the bill passes with that in there, we're going to do some fancy dancing by regulation to define what the average default rate is of the program, because we simply don't want to eliminate loans to students in all of our community, or most of our community colleges in Alaska, and a large percentage of our vocational institutions. The solution that was offered in the House was, how about just taking that out? And I said, that's fine with me, just deleting that whole section. And I would suggest today that may in fact be something you might want to consider as well, because with that out of there, I really don't see a reason to slow down or to halt this bill in any way. I think all it does is set up a mechanism. It doesn't say we're going to issue the bonds. The level of bonds that are going to be issued has to be approved by the legislature. And this simply gives us the mechanism to do that. If the program changes, it may be more attractive fiscally, as Mary Halloran just pointed out. If the program doesn't change, I still find it very attractive, because quite simply, this to me is the survival of the student loan program. The budget that the governor has $39.5 million for student loans. And I'm here to tell you that that's $20 million short. We'll turn away 6,000 to 8,000 students next year. And as opposed to doing that, I certainly endorse bonding. Any questions?
Any questions?
Thank you.
Sterling Gallagher? For the record, I'm Sterling Gallagher. I'm a vice president of the firm of John Devine, an investment banking firm. A couple of comments on the earlier testimony. What the student representative is wrong on one small point, I think Dr. Rumsberg touched on it. The only way that provision about affecting interest rates is move the interest rate down in case of an arbitrage situation. I don't think we have the statutory authority to raise it. As to the cost of the program, the people who say that make the assumption that the state's money is worthless. Now, I can't get up here and say that the state's money is worthless, but if you put a net present value to the savings in this fiscal year through the following on fiscal years, according to the Department of Budget Management, has $100 million net present value savings by adopting this program. And the reason for that is that the student loans are at 8, we're probably borrowing at 6.5. And the way the money floats through the program, it creates enough money to pay the operating expenses of this program. So the savings for this program are at least $100 million plus in a net present value basis. Those who say it doesn't save any money are people who has to assume that the state's money is worthless. I just can't buy that. I want to go through and give you a sectional analysis of the bill to make sure everyone understands what we have here. Section 100, does people have a sectional analysis?
We do. We have one.
Should I go through it?
I don't think so, unless somebody has a specific question.
Okay, then I have those number runs that was put asked for by the OMB, and here they are. So you can see some of the programmatic effects of the various changes. I have. I'll get more printed.
Go ahead, some done.
Okay, version 8 is the base case. In this base case, is all the assumptions like default, forgiveness, default is at 18%, forgiveness is 17%, and grace is the current situation, 1 year after graduation. Those three subsidies amount to 43 cents on the dollar. Every time you make a loan, you're giving away 43 cents. That's why the state appropriation has to be, and that's from a net present value, time value of money approach. That's why the state's appropriation needs to be in the $22 to $25 million range in the first year. And the theory that which we developed the program was the state put up the value of the subsidy to each year in the program. There are two ways to run the program. One, you can cap the loan program at $80 million and decrease the state appropriation, or you can keep the state appropriation at, let's say, $22 million and let the loan program go. And in this program, I wanted to show the impact of the net present value has on the state appropriation approach. You can run the program the other way. I think I have numbers back in the office, but just the other way. The other way, like on the next case, case B, which is not debate, is the case with forgiveness eliminated. The loan program, if you keep the state appropriation at let's say 18.5, it gets up to be about $160 million a year in year 2011. In case B is where forgiveness is adopted, and it really doesn't have much impact on the program until about the fifth or sixth year because of people working through the system and things like that. But you can see out further out, you're only borrowing $14 million a year. You're rapidly paying down the bond issues, and you're also rapidly decrease in the state's appropriation. The system is up and functioning. The system equity is then basically producing the new loans amount.
Charlie, let me ask you a quick question.
Yes.
What interest rate are you basing the bonds on?
I think on 7 in this, but in this market we'd do it at 6.5 to 6.
Mm, 7.
Right. In version C, we eliminated the grace, and you can cut this state appropriation by maybe 10% the first year using that approach. You can see the bond proceeds go down and the state appropriation. If you combine them in program, and which is version D, you can see that the state no longer puts up any money, and the bond proceeds are down to $17 million a year, still keeping up a $80 million a year program. So those things in conjunction with the bonding program, any strengthening of the program, I think would be very beneficial. The things that the governor's office talked about, I think would be beneficial, like using the permit fund dividends. I also talked to them using the Department of Revenue. The Department of Revenue has an agreement with the IRS where we exchange information. I do not believe under that agreement you can exchange information on loan programs. There's a specific prohibition, but you can at least find out what the guy's address is. And if you can find the guy's address, you can collect these loans. These are a student loan is one thing that survives bankruptcy. So the biggest impediment to it is finding these people and bringing them into court. So there are ways that the default rate can be worked on.
Any questions? I want to ask one of Dr. Romsberg, but you can stay there. I think the mic will pick you up. When we get into the default area, this seems to be the thing we really fall apart on. Do we file automatically with the credit bureau when somebody is in default?
Yes, we do.
We do. So if they go to buy a new car or something, that's going to be on that credit report.
It's a national network.
Great. Okay. Good. Well, thank you. Anybody else that we missed? What we'll do then is we'll just carry this bill over until Friday. We're short one, but the public hearing at this point is over. So we'll look at the bill on Friday for a vote. But we're one short, I think, of really doing it legitimately. So, but we can take testimony on the next bill. So thank you. Okay, the last item that we'll be taking testimony on, and then of course Friday, hopefully we'll be able to yay or nay whether it should survive the committee, is SR 10, the Senate Special Committee on AIDS Prevention. And we'll just take a couple minute break.
Thank you.
You may be aware, Senator Jones, we're just going to recess for 5 minutes.